You are now listening to Jason Halsey on the Liminalist, a podcast between talking to Kathy Morgan. As always, the question is, you know, where is going to be most fruitful to focus? And I know that you're doing a lot of mapping, just as I was doing a lot of mapping some time ago around my own family, particularly around Yorkshire, but it did obviously extend outward to the whole planet, inevitably. There's obviously a lot of material to look into there. On the other hand, you're doing that, your blog and in these other interviews, so I thought it might be more productive not to focus on the actual details or the names and the places and the informational aspect so much as, one thing actually before, I mean, looking at the more general questions of what's going on and how it seems to be affecting us individually and collectively. And those deeper questions, I am interested in, maybe briefly or maybe not, looking at any correspondences in what your findings and my own. But I don't know how, I mean, I'm not very up to date on yours, I don't think, and I'm not sure how up to scratch you are on mine. I found out about you because you were commenting at the blog, so clearly you were finding certain overlaps there. I remember specifically with the psychiatric workers being trained at London School of Economics, how that seemed to tie in with all of this. I remember that specific overlap. But are there any other particular areas that stand out for you that you want to mention at the start?
As you say, that's the article I came across, which I was quite excited about because I hadn't cut and done to some of the information in it. However, I then went to read some more and tried to start The Prisoner of Infinity and read it all, but I ended up reading a few parts and then I couldn't find a part, and you know, I drifted off and drifted back into your latest article, and then I found Sully Zuckerman, what I call the Sully Zuckerman article, The Thousand Parts, which was exciting because I just found them too. So
you
found
what them. Was that last thing that you said that you found?
Tots and Pops.
Oh, yeah, the Tots and Pops, yeah, because I do mention them, don't I, in the mass observation thing. It was totally unfamiliar to me, but, yeah.
Yeah. So there's the overlap for sure. But I did, as I say, I was quite coming lately to your work, and so I haven't got the whole thing, as you say, either.
Those two areas are particularly interesting to me in terms of being looking like tips of an iceberg. So on the one hand, the London School of Economics beginning to train psychiatric care workers in 1929, the year coincidentally that Jimmy Savile was born, and how that later extended or developed in the Tavistock and kind of in much more mapped areas of social engineering. Just that kind of indication that something was beginning back then that would somehow provide context to Jimmy Savile and how he was involved with the National Health Service, and you know, the possibility that he was doing more than just getting his kicks, right? That he was actually doing something that he was assigned to do. And then also the mass observation, and this was perhaps even more tenuous, but the way in which evidence suggested that dance halls were part of a social engineering plan to, well, I won't say for what, but just in terms of observation of mass behavior, and also seeding kind of means and creating ideology or shaping ideologies through music, etc. But also because dance halls were often gang run, so there's prostitution, there's drugs, there's all that element. And Jimmy Savile, came to ascended in that world of dance halls. So there just seemed to be a very kind of tantalizing, unexcavated collection of artifacts there around that.
That's quite an evocative imagery of how it was then. It almost brings it to life when you imagine the difference. The dance halls were where people gathered. It was so different from today. And I do find this, doing this research fascinating in a historical sense. That has given me a sense of history that is quite... it's almost quite addictive, really.
Yeah. Is that something you wrestle with then, the potentially compulsive nature of it?
I work with it.
Right. Yeah. I just ask because it was an ongoing pull of war with me. Like, am I just addicted? Is this just compulsive fingering at the wound? I turned a corner with Occult at Yorkshire because I found so much evidence that it was so validating in some way to some basic unease in my psyche that something was wrong, that something happened to me, and that my version of history, my memory, my personal history was somehow false. All of those feelings, like the splinter in the brain thing, were confirmed so powerfully that I just realized, oh, wait a minute, this... It may be compulsive, but it's a healthy compulsion. It's a necessary compulsion.
Exactly. Well, I did sort of engage a counsellor about 6 months ago who's good with trauma. I've never had that opportunity, but it arose. So we got to know each other quite well, and I talked to her about if it was obsessive, and I was so pleased because she'd started taking an interest and pricking her ears up when I was talking about it, and she emphasised that it was a healthy thing and it was a really excellent thing to do. And she was way ahead of me and thinking it might be institutionalised or some sort of organised paedophilia scenario that I hadn't even occurred to me, and I think she's right.
Hmm. So she was instrumental then in kind of emboldening you to dig deeper.
I was over the moon. And then just a few weeks later, I do feel I'm even seeing kind of closure because of the amount of information I have got, that feeling of feeling, as you say, vindicated. It's so empowering when you do see the names coming fast and furious and it all seems to tumble into place. So I'm seeing closure on that era, but I can't wait to move on to the 70s.
Well, when did you begin the exploration?
About 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And that was around the time that you spoke to this therapist, or that was later?
No, that's when I started seeing the some things online about people talking about deep underground bases and being super soldiers. And for some reason, I just thought, oh my goodness, as soon as somebody introduced the concept that there might be interference in someone's life, then it just rang a bell for me.
Mm-hmm. Because you felt that you had been interfered with.
Yeah, that our family had been, and it's an explanation that had never offered itself up for one moment before. Never had I thought of that could have happened to me until then.
Mm. So you weren't familiar with the conspiracy narratives back 6 years ago?
It kind of was, perhaps for the year previous, I had been looking at that aspect of things on the internet, so for about a year, and then I was kind of led in that sense I think it was the British stuff, though, that I just thought I'd seen MKUltra, and I just thought it was over in America. We don't do things like that in England.
Yeah.
And of course, it, right from the beginning, I thought, oh, I'm crazy. What am I doing? You know, I'm just imagining this right from the start. You know, the whole voice, but I persevered because I'm like, no, hold on, you know. There's anomalies here, but I hadn't identified them, so I sat down and literally plotted it out, painstakingly slowly, really, but eventually it did become very exciting work.
Do you think there was a... So how old were you when you actually began the explorations?
52.
Oh, that in the Mayan system, that's a beginning of a whole new cycle for the human beings. Oh. Yeah, that's like they, you change your Mayan glyph at the age of 52, so you, kind of your fundamental character shifts into a different phase. Is how the Mayans look at it, apparently.
That is very interesting.
So do you think that? I mean, presumably, you must have been in some way laying the groundwork for those first 52 years that made it possible for you to embark on these, the journey into the underworld, so to speak. Are you aware now of how you were doing that, how you were laying groundwork in your own psyche to be ready for, to start seeing these things?
Do you know, yes, that's something I did, and I remember doing it... as a very young child, laying in a sort of anchoring a memory in to remember about what was happening, and then forgetting it until, as I say, I was 52, started looking and I remembered that piece of information as a child that I'd put away. That was kind of weird.
So that's like the compartmentalization thing that's being exploited by the agents of MKUltra, etc. But that you were doing yourself instinctively, or because you'd actually had it done to you and had learned it, do you think?
Actually, that's an interesting concept, that it might have been done to me, and hence that's why I did that. That is interesting. I shall ponder that.
Like I said, it's very, there's so many different ways to approach this, and I do, you know, because we have a shared experience insofar as this basic experience of discovering our own involvement in much larger agendas, and the ways in which our consciousness has been hacked by that, and how we're not who we think we are, that basic experience. In my case, I mean, one of the ways that seems fruitful is looking at the differences, perhaps, and in my case was, and this is one of the sources of my confusion to this day, I think, is that I was familiar with these kind of narratives, from the early 20s. I think I must have first heard of MKUltra in my early 20s, and you know, other stuff around that, and I was deeply into the occult. I was into Aleister Crowley also in my early 20s through to my 30s, and I was on a shamanic path, so I got really deeply involved in all of that world, and I took it on so quickly and so easily. I took it all to heart. Like, as soon as I heard, you know, any kind of, I don't want to say conspiracy theory, but any kind of, you know, alternate version of history, whether it was John Lennon or whether it was AIDS or whether it was Charles Manson or, you know, whatever it was, I immediately kind of believed it because of this underlying sense that I'd been lied to and I'd got it all wrong. So I took on all of this stuff for decades and even wrote books about it, but it's only in the last 5 years or something that I began to see, even though I might have entertained it theoretically, to see that I appear to actually have direct experience of it, And it's almost as though all of that reading and believing that I did before is a hindrance at this point, rather than a help. You know what I mean?
Throwing it,
Because it's
yes, it maybe it's this and maybe it's that kind of.
well, because there's already a sort of tidily constructed narrative. I don't know how tidy it is, but I think relative to, how complex the reality is, the conspiracy narrative's pretty tidy with Tavistock and MKUltra and all the rest of them, all these usual names that keep popping up, which don't pop up in your narrative and they don't really pop up in mine, but they do connect to the mainstream. Well, it's not really mainstream, but the mainstream conspiracy narrative. So one of my confusion in this is that I'd kind of rejected all that Tavistock stuff just because I just found it wasn't trustable. It just felt wrong somehow. David Icke and all these guys, Alex Jones, it's just like, no, it's not like that. There's so much more subtlety to it. But as I've been uncovering stuff around my own history, it seems as though, well, actually, it kind of is. It is
It is.
almost. It is almost like, but that's really confusing because I still think that a large part of that stuff is disinformation, even though they seem to have the right dates and the right names and the right institutions. Somehow it, you know what I mean? It just doesn't quite, it doesn't represent.
How it really is. It almost makes you think, oh, yeah, that's never happened to me. But it probably does happen. You know, when you hear Alex Jones and David Icke. And they've got a kind of slant on it because, as you say, our stuff does connect in with those institutions and organizations around the edges, if you like, or underneath or somewhere. Well, but people have talked about them as with just this pat little narrative or story, which is almost too convenient, like you say. And it's just sure, it's more subtle. And that's because we're
Pervasive.
looking at our own situation, so we're getting the subtleties. If you're looking out there and trying to investigate it and explain it, then it's not subtle. But when you've experienced it's some aspect of it. It's trying to place it in that bigger picture that is the way to communicate it, I think, ultimately. Because it's so complex.
Yeah, and so multi-layered, and so kind of intrinsic, so imminent. Like it's we are we're engineered by these agendas that we're uncovering, and so even the ways in which we look at the evidence is shaped and influenced by that engineering. So it's as though you can't actually understand it by looking at it outside as something separate from you. You'll never actually really be able to understand it because it's inside. It's an internal hardwiring, and that's where one's own direct interface with it is right there. It's right under our noses. I think that's what you're saying. So yeah, the somehow, that's very true that David Icke and whoever is presenting these narratives in a way that they're compelling and convincing to some people, obviously not to many people, but to people like us. And yet, there's an underlying kind of implication that, yes, this is happening to other people still. And the same with Jimmy's, the same with the sexual abuse thing. It always felt like it was other people.
Even when you do sort of, it is helpful that they've done that research on the wider aspect. So once you do get your bearings and kind of start placing yourself in that picture that they've built and factual, they are handy reference points. If I think doing it on your own for yourself is very different. You haven't got any other influences to distort your research apart from just absolutely just looking for the truth. So I think that's important to keep in place, and which is why I can't really make any money from anything I do in this quest, because you know, I might suddenly get popular, you know, want to be, make it more popular or something, and get taken off course. I kind of feel like, and that seems to be what is the, if someone out there has a slant, any kind of agenda, then it does distort the information.
Yeah, I think that's it, exactly. And I think there's, it's almost like it provides a safety valve to prevent remembering, to prevent integration, because you can account for some of the tension in the psyche by, and relieve some of the tension by putting your attention on these narratives that are being created by others. But it's like fiction. Even if it's not fiction, it's like fiction, because you're escaping into it, and then you close the book, or you turn off the YouTube video or whatever, and you say, wow, that was interesting stuff, and now I'll carry on, you know, now I'll carry on living my life. And then that would relieve some of the tension, just as watching horror movies and other forms.
Yeah, very much so. I have to confess that I did find it very much like watching science fiction in the beginning, and enjoyed it as much, which sometimes people complain about, oh, people are just not taking this seriously. I wasn't taking it too seriously. I was quite enthralled, especially about around things like Montauk and the Philadelphia Experiment and so on. I loved it.
Right.
But coming to think of it, I'm not sure that I've ever, you know, in this research you do come across certain points and they sort of shock you, because they're about your information, they're about what you're looking for, and it's about your very close circumstances, and you get quite sharp and excited even once you've assimilated it. But I don't think I've ever come across that by listening to somebody else. I think that's always been from researching documents and papers and stuff.
Yeah, same here. And then it was necessary for me to take that route, because I was looking for stuff around my grandfather or my brother or people that they're not. Obviously, David Icke's not talking about people in my own sphere, because my family wasn't, well, I don't know how central they were, but they certainly weren't pushed towards the front in any way, you know, even in terms of conventional history, and not in terms of, you know, conspiratorial history either. It does seem that they were quite key players, but there's very little out there, is what I'm saying, in terms of information, so I just had to dig as deep as possible in Google Books or wherever, just for a name here or word there. And then I would find a tidbit like that my grandfather was one of two primary backers of the Round Table in Britain.
Oh my goodness.
I know, and I'm like, what? This, you know.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that, and that's obviously, and I don't know about the Round Table except through this conspiracy literature. But that's kind of my point, is this, and the Bilderbergs, anyway, it doesn't matter the details, but it was a couple of degrees of separation. I'd follow one to go to that, and then suddenly I'm in David Icke land. I see Aleister Crowley kept popping.
Yeah, he does too. And I think it's when that happens, what I see is you're looking at history from a different viewpoint completely. So you've got the account of the Round Table that's somewhere maybe stored in your memory from where you may have ever come across it in academic and historical ways, which is completely accepted. Good old Cecil Rhodes, what he's done for us.
Yes.
And so then all of a sudden you come across it from a different point of view completely. And that's a bit of a kind of struggle for me sometimes is that, hold on, this is actually accepted, this is mainstream, that I'm holding up as conspiracy, it's published academic stuff.
Yeah.
But it becomes too you can't challenge it really when you start mapping it all together and putting it together like a jigsaw. When you put these facts side by side, that's when they become glaringly, obviously nefarious.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think that, but perhaps that's also why it's very much an individual thing, because A, it requires a lot of time and attention and care to actually look at all the pieces, and even to present those pieces to some, you know, even if somebody's presenting those pieces, it takes a while, right? You've got to look at all the pieces. You can't just look at the picture. B, I think that it's still not the same unless you're in the puzzle. That's the thing, you know. Your map that you've created, you're in it. My map, I'm in it. I'm actually on it. And needless to say, that makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
And some people could say that means we can't be objective, but, I mean, of course it does in some sense. But on the other hand, you're seeing it from the inside, so you can see more clearly that it does fit. I mean, the thing is for me that, and I imagine it's the same for you in a different way, that putting the pieces together, like whether it's my grandfather with round table or what have you, etc., all his connections to these elite plutocrats when he was supposedly a socialist, it made sense of my experience of growing up in that family and how hypocritical it was and how it didn't seem to be what it was pretending to be. Like, there was always this weird incongruence about it that started to come clear. So then that of course lends an enormous amount of substance to what I'm discovering, if it's making the picture clearer, if it's making it more coherent.
Yeah, and you almost reach a point of a point where things just come so quickly, and if you're on the inside looking around, then your task is how, you know, there's so much, because there's something there, there's a huge amount there, because it's true, you know, so you do find pieces come hugely when you're doing it about yourself. And I think if more people did this and do this, I think they probably will, that you get an alternative view of history that is very interesting and detailed. And in the sense that the detail itself is what makes it irrefutable.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's right. And it also prevents creating a picture prematurely, turning it into a narrative prematurely. Because I'm using him a bit too, it's just convenient, but David Icke, he's created a consistent narrative. You more or less know, what David Icke's going to talk about, because he, and it's not just him, I mean, he's just one example. The general conspiracy, I would say conspiratainment narrative is consistent and coherent up to a point, but I think it's probably a false coherence, because I can't turn what I've discovered into a narrative, or at least if it is, it's much more like Moby Dick than it is like I can't think of a counterexample now, but Harry Potter or whatever, you know, it's so nuanced, and I can't at this point. You mentioned, I can't remember the word, it was malevolence or a similar word to that, that when you put the picture together you see something malevolent. Well, I would agree, but I would also disagree in the sense that I would disagree in the sense that I can't, it's so big and so nuanced, this picture, that I can't say with any authority that this is a malevolent agenda. Like, it's like evolutionary engineering, so it's almost like looking at God's plan in a way. I mean, not really, but a low level kind of social. It's like looking at the Matrix, like the whole thing is programmed. So I don't feel I can comment on it. However, the way in which I can say, yeah, this is destructive is that, and this is what I try to do throughout Occult Yorkshire, is always connecting it back to the systemized torture rape of children. That runs through all of it. You don't ever have to go far. You don't have to join too many dots to get to Jimmy Savile or the craze or the corresponding, you know, that nexus of torture and the horror, you know, the most horrific kind of behaviors that we can maybe even imagine, but certainly that we generally think about, is part of it, and that has to be, that absolutely has to be
touched on.
Yeah, and allowed to form, and once it's part of the picture, it kind of, it changes everything. I mean, it just changes everything. If these are the means, right? If the means are brutalizing, torturing and killing children, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to finish that sentence, but really, I mean, can we even imagine an end?
Yeah, how wrong can it be? It didn't get any worse than that, didn't it, really?
No. So, you know, in our culture, the way we've been conditioned, we think of that kind of behavior as psychopathic, depraved, and in other words, that it can't possibly have a rational basis. But of course, what we've seen, I think, I say we as in you and I, is that it does have a rational basis to it.
Yeah. I'm getting an insight into, I mean, those kind of things I would just turn away from if I'd seen them, because, you know, I express sort of horror, but not kind of dwell on, as you say, but now I'm getting more of an inkling into how they come about, these situations, and machinations behind it all, the blackmail and the manipulation and the power over others in influential positions. It's starting to become make more sense and become, you know, a part of my real world now.
So you mean that because you mentioned that earlier about how your therapist said that the pedophilia was institutionalized and you were shocked by that. So you're saying that that part of the narrative, keep using that term, that part of this reality is one that you have only started taking on board later.
In my personal circumstances, I started not being so naive as to trust everyone. You know, 58. And so it kind of coincided with seeing the world as having this evil very much as a real thing, as that could be, you know, I have to incorporate it and take steps to protect myself with people in case they're not trustworthy. That's happened at the same time. It's almost like I had to come to that point personally before I could take on board that, you know, it's not always good in everyone, and this very optimistic view of people that I use.
I see. So you're talking about the ways in which it directly impacted your just everyday experience of being with people.
Yeah, I have to accept that there are such things in town, say, or a village you walk through, and there could be a pedophile ring, and several people that you see could be involved. I have to accept that. Now, and I have, and that coincided with my understanding that people, that I had to put boundaries out with people and in relationships and stand up for myself right from the word go, rather than being so, you know, all things to all people, kind of was my way of avoiding trouble, I think, before that. So a profound change happens in me as well at that time. Over a number of years, perhaps a couple to 3 years, you know, it's a process.
I think I was the opposite way then, in terms of, again, looking at a contrast, that I think as far back as I can remember, I distrusted people and felt that they were capable of terrible things, including myself, and just generally, well, kept to myself. I mean, I was very solitary, but also just was not open with people. So I think I'm actually learning to be more open now that I'm.
I was shy and solitary, but I put it down to a fault within me, as opposed to a fault within other people.
Yeah, I guess I did too. It was both, I think. But I don't think I ever had any illusions, is what I'm saying about. That we're living in a world that is run through with depravity and destructive individuals. It's just you never think it's the person in front of you, and I still don't, not really. It's just that I know that it must be, some of the time it must be this person standing in front of me. I just don't know when. So, but you have reason to believe that there's something in your own childhood corresponding with these actions, no?
Yes.
Or not?
Yeah. It's looking like when I came across the fact that Kinsey was literally he's published in his books that they brought babies and young children to orgasm and timed it. And so on, and so there was this kind of institutionalized paedophilia going on in the academic world, and it was being embraced as the permissive society was being ushered in. The Kinsey Report, because it dealt with adults too, was held up as an example of how everyone could be all free and liberated, And yet, in it were these paedophile experiments. So, I'm now working on the premise that that could be what my father was involved in some way. Because there were twins, I am a twin, and one child, one was sexually abused, the other wasn't. And that in combination with a lot of other testing and surveying of us as a family, it seems to be a distinct possibility. So, yeah, and so I had dreams as a child that indicated some group, my father meeting some men in a group in robes and being humiliated. And I think I'm even based on some sort of memory. So, yeah.
How old were you?
And that he might have actually been involved with people who persuaded him to become involved in something about us, about the children, and that they would be made successful or given more opportunities or made more intelligent. I'm sure something along those lines may well have happened.
What was your father's work?
My father was, at that time, he was the assistant manager, but a very hands-on in a small maltster's work where the malt for the barley was being steamed and processed for beer, for a small brewing company. However, at that time, all the brewing companies were taken over by one large company. So his company was the last in the takeover of the family breweries in the UK, and the old families had a presence on the board, but it was a big company. It was called the Association of British Maltsters, but there was a lot of American influence. They bought it the year we moved down there, and that's the one, that's the company, the ABM, that's what Peter Parker became the director of in 1970, Sir Peter Parker, who brought Jimmy Savile in as the face of British Rail when he was chairman of British Rail.
Right. So, what made you think that of the twins, is this in your case or in general, that one was sexually abused and another wasn't?
No, that's my personal experience.
And what do you base that on?
That was what actually happened. I was the twin that was abused.
And how do you know that your other twin wasn't?
Oh, I asked her.
And how do you know that she would remember if she was?
Yeah, I actually, that is something that I perhaps shouldn't have taken so definitely when she said no. And my counsellor has pointed this out to me, that she, just because she said no, it doesn't mean to say she wasn't. But however, I have very clear memories because it went on to the age of 12. So I have very, very clear memories. So I assume that if she had been, then she would have memories of it too. So she just said she doesn't. But I know for a fact she was sexually abused by my cousin, who was kind of about 5 years older than us. But her attitude to that seems to be, oh, well, never mind, these things happened.
Right.
Yeah.
But and is there any basis for the idea of twins abusing one and not the other as some sort of experimental control thing, or is that just not relevant?
There's lots of examples of one doing something to one twin and not the other, and how valuable it is for research. So I haven't specifically come across the sexual abuse thing, but it just seems very obvious.
Right.
Because the designers of this survey were actually studying different kinds of trauma in childhood and what impact they had on the child from the age of 11. If something happened up to the age of 11, how that would affect their course in life. a certain trauma or going to a certain kind of school, and he was looking into this, and we were sent back to Rochdale at the age of 11. So I'm sure that we were part of a more covert aspect of this survey in ways that my parents hadn't grasped.
Well, one of the ways that one of the primary ways that I began to accept that I have some sort of sexual abuse in my past was looking at my brother and recognizing that he showed the symptoms of sexual abuse, and then seeing the ways in which he and I sort of played off each other, how different we were in many ways, but how similar in other ways in our extremes. And sort of by recognizing the symptoms in him, I began to recognize the symptoms in myself.
Nice.
So with your sister, would you say that she is very different from you and that she doesn't exhibit signs of somebody who's traumatized?
Oh, she's definitely traumatized. She pointed that out to me and explained that she's traumatized. But she thinks it was from my mum being narcissistic. So she thinks then, but my mum would always insist that we went to every single shop to look at every single possible dress before we went back to the first one, because that was the best one, and it drove us mad, really. And now my sister can't go. She's got a phobia about taking her time in a shop. She has to run in and run out again.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Well, I can see how a narcissistic mother could lead to trauma, but not through excess shopping, if you know what I mean.
Well, it's always lots of little things that don't seem much on their own, and there's always plausible deniability. That's how they seem to operate under the radar.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what were your memories of your father growing up, and in terms of how you see him now and you're considering the possibilities about him now, how much were you aware of something back then, even, if at all?
It's kind of, he had two faces, really. He was a most attractive and gentle and principled man. And yet, my mum was cold, habitual, narcissistic, narrow-minded, racist. So obviously there was another side to him. She was maybe manifesting another side to his nature, if you like, for him. That can happen. So I had this sort of schizophrenic sort of view of him, in the sense that I absolutely adored him as a little girl, and I was absolutely furious with him as someone who's completely shocked and traumatized me. But I'm sure it happened. Oh, it didn't happen until we got to Bath, after we'd been in Bath for about a year.
How old, and what happened then?
Well, my family moved to Bath when I was 4. Just as we just turned 4, and we'd been hot-housed, and I was reading before we went to school, so we were just turned, had our first birthday, went to school right away, but I was reading right then, so I must have been reading at 3. So we weren't getting affection or normal family, a normal family life. We were getting this hot housing and this behaviourism.
What do you mean by hot housing?
Being taught from a very young age to read, basically, and perform poems and songs and things.
And this was within your family. This was in the normal sort of memory timeline, or this is something that.
I remember it. It went on very before we were 4, obviously. We were reading by then, but my mum was a nursery nurse, and as you know, well, as your article pointed out, the London School of Economics was very much involved. It's like a Tavistock area, the Nursery Nurses. And so I think somebody had got very much into her mind about teaching your children to read and how important it was and how you could do it from an early age. You know, because she's not the sort of person you could really have a conversation with about it. She wouldn't really know. She's more of a follower, you know. She's very, I hate to say, but she's very mind-controlled.
That's quite a good example of something that is potentially really intrusive and even violatory, but that is completely unquestioned, and that is teaching a child to read. Like, it seems, you know, we're conditioned to think of that as a good thing and as basically harmless as well as useful. But I think I read a while ago about tribes that, well, they do have reading cultures, but they wait until much later, till the child's 10 or something, before teaching it to read. I don't remember what that was, but I remember the context was is that reading, because it rewires the brain in ways that don't allow for healthy development.
Yeah, I know the Rudolf Steiner education specifically says don't even start till the 7, because they think more creatively in different ways, and you know, as children, and they're not ready at 7. Going to read. Yeah, it's not a healthy relationship to have with your children. I think there's something more fundamental that should be there, at least. And then if you have the child's cooperation and curiosity, and it's made fun. But for us, it was made a chore, and it's something that we had to do. You know, it was about being good or not being good. But it wasn't healthy. I don't know if that was set up as some kind of eugenic experiment in itself, because we were being visited by those doctors since birth, every 3 months. I imagine they were liaising with my mum and giving her instructions. But I need to get to the bottom of this. My mum isn't really with it anymore, because my dad did pass away in January. So she's become like half a person. So I don't think I'll be able to talk to her again. I might try. I'm not in the same country anymore at the moment. So I feel very liberated to be able to talk fully and openly now that he has passed away, which I hadn't done before.
Right. Yeah, I think that's often the case. It's kind of ironic or tragic, because by that time then you can't reality check with the people who are most likely to know something. But in my own case, both my parents were gone by the time I began. My father was quite long gone, and my mother had just passed, really, by the time I started looking into this. And then I have some uncles and aunts who are still alive, who have become aware of what I'm doing, just enough to let me know that they disapprove strongly, but also inadvertently to confirm that I was on the right track, because one of them acknowledged, while saying that I was getting it all wrong, acknowledged that my grandfather met with one of the members of PI, and, you know, Paedophile Information Exchange, and how he was talking about adults loving children and how healthy it was, and that actually my aunt was at one of those meetings and remembered it. But anyway, that was a side point.
It's a very valuable piece of information for you.
For me, yeah, that's right. I mean, just to know, okay, so that's it. I mean, because that was one of the things I was absolutely looking for, because it seemed highly, highly likely with my grandfathers and my father's and his brother, you know, my uncles and aunts, that side, the paternal side of my family, their intense involvement with social reform, with liberalist causes and all the rest of it, homosexuality. And my grandfather was all into convicts, you know, visiting convicts and helping them rehabilitate. It seemed highly, highly likely that they would have some connection with the paedophile information exchange, but I couldn't find anything, and then it just came back to me. Due to their finding out about what I'm doing and being really disturbed and upset by it and insisting that I was getting it all wrong, and yet it's kind of somehow confirming it with this memory, you know?
Yeah. Isn't that infuriating when you know they know something and they're not telling you?
Yeah, and I think I heard you saying something on one of your interviews similar, maybe, but I don't even want to try and talk to them, even if they were willing, because, or at least I would be very ambivalent, because I just would find it so difficult, knowing that they are going to deny at one level or another. It just feels like a minefield, you know? I mean, for obvious reasons, really, because it's so difficult to find the ground and just stay on the little bit of ground that one finds, and so then to talk to people who are there and to risk having them saying, no, no, you're imagining it, it's all nonsense, which is, you know, presumably to some extent would kind of repeat the patterns that we grew up in, which were, we knew something was happening but nobody was acknowledging it or admitting to it.
I pretty much spoke to everyone in the beginning, and I kind of came to that conclusion that I wasn't going to be speaking to them again, because for various reasons, they just didn't want to know, or they felt upset, or they just looked at me like I was bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
So I pretty much upset everyone and went around and found out what they knew as much as I could at that time. It was almost like you can only play that card once, you know, because they're going to close up after the first encounter with you asking these questions.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get the sense that somebody was actually lying to you?
With my mum, I don't think she realised that she was lying. She just simply couldn't remember certain things that she really ought to remember. Mm. But my brother-in-law definitely was withholding information, because I think he felt that this sort of research was dangerous, and that his wife and children, that's my twin, and the children might be in some danger if I was to carry on digging.
Did he get angry with you?
No, he seemed to be very pleasant. But then one day I was at their house and their daughter was doing a family tree, and I was doing the family tree, and she said, oh, have you come across Sir John Cockcroft yet? And I said, no. And her dad looked at her and she goes, oh, well, they're not supposed to say that. I thought, he's withholding information from me. But I found out from my sister that her attitude is, I don't put your head above the parapet. And if anything is upsetting, or it has to do with you, put it in a box over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what they were doing. So I think it was a fear that you might be inviting trouble if you draw attention to yourself by doing this research and telling people.
Do you have any children?
I do. I have six children.
Wow.
I have lost my son, so that there are five living children now.
Hmm.
But they're all grown up. My youngest is 23.
Are they aware of what you're doing?
Yeah, I did share it with them in the beginning, and they were interested, and they believe me.
Hmm.
So that was huge, really.
Yeah,
and they like to see the mum keeping busy, you know. Something to do, you know, meeting people, getting out and about. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I think it is dangerous work, but maybe not in the way that your sister's implying. I mean, I think there is that element, but I think it's probably less than in terms of just uncovering too much unconscious material too quickly, and how that obviously it causes instability, destabilization, and then one can, I don't know, I mean there are various ways that can, if it moves too fast, I think there's a danger there.
Yeah, that's the danger. It's unlikely that you're going to become in real danger from outside, I think, unless you actually stumble on something specific that's a real threat to someone powerful inadvertently, because that's not what we're trying to do. It's not a witch hunt. We're trying to uncover the truth. We're not trying to out forget people, obviously.
No, I'm not. I mean, you say obviously, but some people do have that urge, certainly, I think. I mean, obviously, some people have it, but I mean, some people who are uncovering stuff, I know somebody who is feeling very angry about it, and part of that does lead to a desire to, and, you know, to some extent, I had that. I mean, I certainly wanted my family to know what I was doing, and I didn't hold back in terms of, because at least one of them is quite powerful. I mean, he was Tony Blair's right-hand man, and I mean, it seems as though it was somewhat risky to upset people like that. But on the other hand, this is my life.
Exactly. Yeah, because when you do it about yourself, you own it, and it is yours.
Yeah.
And that's how I felt.
That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Kathy Morgan, and part two will be up next Wednesday, the 13th of July. Kathy's blog is called UK Mind Manipulation. It's kathkey.wordpress.com. You can find the link to that in the show notes. I'd like to thank my monthly subscribers, you know who you are, and encourage anyone else to contribute. Also like to thank one-off donator Daryl, thanks for that. This is The Liminalist. Next week is another week. Next week is another week. Just a reminder that I do have another podcast at newbooksnetwork.com at more or less regular intervals of about twice a month, talking to authors of recent books in hidden history.